From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Martin Ostermuhl. I'm Kojo Namdi. Tom Sherwood is off today. Our guest analyst is Martin Ostermuhl. He's a reporter for WAMU. Martin, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Will Smith. He's a member of the Maryland Senate, representing District 20, which is in Montgomery County. But joining us now in studio is Justin Fairfax. He is the Lieutenant Governor of Virginia. Lieutenant Governor Fairfax, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo and Martin. It's great to be back with you.
Before we get to Virginia, Martin Ostermuhl, let's talk the District of Columbia. The ethics director of the District of Columbia, who works for what is known as the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability, is apparently on the firing line, so to speak. He might be losing his job. Brent Wolfenbarger.
Yeah, so Mitch Riles, Loose Lips of the City paper, reported that he had gotten word that Mr. Wolfenbarger, who is the director of ethics for the D.C. government, is on thin ice when it comes to his job. There's been concerns about how the Board of Elections and Government Accountability, which was created 6 years ago after a raft of scandals in the D.C. Council to kind of handle ethics management and kind of enforcement across the D.C. government, there's concern that it's not really living up to its job. It's not answering complaints that are filed by people within the government in due time. And there's some displeasure on the D.C. Council. There was a hearing a couple weeks ago where some council members took him to task over how they were managing these complaints that are filed by D.C. government officials regarding ethics concerns. And obviously the timing isn't great. You've got the whole scandal with Jack Evans going on now in the council, and there's concerns about, you know, the city creates this enforcement, this ethics enforcement office, essentially. Is it really enforcing those ethics rules? Has it fallen flat on its face? Does it need to be changed? And this is just 5 years after it was created.
And you mentioned the scandal involving Ward 2 council member Jack Evans. House Republicans wanted to bring that scandal into the conversation, the hearing that was scheduled on statehood for the District of Columbia. They actually wanted Mr. Evans to come and testify at the hearing because their argument is apparently that the District of Columbia should be maybe denied statehood because of this alleged corruption that has taken place, because of the corruption that's taken place in the city.
Yeah, exactly. So earlier in the fall, there was a hearing up on the Hill on this bill that would, if passed, would allow the district to become the 51st state. One of the main talking points by Republicans against it, at least one, you know, one that they were repeating, was, you know, the district government isn't ready for statehood yet. The district isn't ready for statehood because of allegations of corruption within the government. And obviously, in that case, Jack Evans is a perfect foil for them. They say, look at what Jack Evans is accused of. This means you can't manage your finances responsibly. And of course, city officials say, no, listen, we've had 22 years of balanced budgets. We've got a surplus. We're doing just fine compared to Congress, which can't even pass a budget in most cases. And then there's folks that point out the very obvious case that there's lots of states that have corrupt officials, too.
I was about to say, if having a corrupt elected official was a standard for getting or not getting statehood, there would probably be no states in the union even as we speak. So we can move on from that to our guest. He is Justin Fairfax, the Lieutenant Governor of Virginia. This week you made headlines when you said you plan to run for governor in 2021, but you've mentioned the possibility of running for governor before, but perhaps not as strongly as saying, I plan to run. Last time you were on this show, you said that running for governor is something that you were thinking about. Now you're saying you plan to run. Can you give us a sense of how likely you are to run and what factors are going into your decision?
Yeah, well, thank you again, Kojo, for having me. Thank you, Martin. We did announce that I do plan to run for governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia in 2021. And we've seen tremendous excitement around that announcement.
What's the difference between saying you're planning to run and officially announcing that you're running?
So it's a great question. And I'm a lawyer and a whole bunch of lawyers here. But obviously, when you start running, it triggers certain legal obligations and disclosures and things. So you'd want to get all of that in order. But, you know, we wanted to make it clear to everyone that is, you know, our intent. And again, the response has been really tremendous and positive and overwhelming. And I've traveled all around the Commonwealth of Virginia, as you know, really over the last 7 years, but as lieutenant governor over the last two. And we've been to every part of Virginia, southwest, south side. I was just in Roanoke and Danville. I was in Norfolk yesterday in Hampton Roads. And, you know, everywhere we go, I mean, there are crowds of people who are just energized by the positive message, the more hopeful politics that we represent. And they're really, frankly, tired of people who try to tear people in communities down. And they want people who are going to build people in communities up. And that's really what we've represented in politics in Virginia.
In February, you were accused of sexual misconduct by two women, both allegations you have denied. How have those allegations affected your thinking about running for governor?
You know, I think what people have gotten to see over the last 10 months is that these allegations were false, fabricated, and politically motivated. And anyone who's really paying attention and asking really direct questions about the facts and the evidence and the truth see that these have been debunked. And in fact, we have called, as you know, for the past 10 months for investigations and independent investigations, criminal investigations. I've taken and passed two lie detector tests, which we have released to the public. And now we've sued CBS for $400 million for their reckless disregard for the truth and airing these false accusations, despite the fact that there's been evidence and information that these allegations are false. And so, you know, as folks like to sort of just rehash these, you know, mindlessly rehash these allegations without actually asking questions, are they true? And asking questions specifically about each of the cases, you know, Virginians have really rejected that. And again, for anyone who wants to kind of just keep talking about this without actually asking the specific questions, I would tell them, please call Nancy Erica Smith, who is the lawyer for Meredith Watson, the accuser from Duke, and ask her some very simple questions. Whose dorm room did this happen in, and was there anyone else there? Because they can't answer those questions, because once they answer them, for 5 months, they have refused to answer those questions because it will reveal that Meredith Watson fabricated the story. Dr. Vanessa Tyson as well. We've shown many fabrications in her account, including that she, you know, claims to have met me on a day that I wasn't even in the city, where she didn't know me. And so, you know, we have been transparent. We have told the truth from day one. And Virginians are incredibly smart. I give them so much more credit than most people in politics. They were able to see right through this. And here we are 10 months later, and people say they remain unresolved. Well, you know, smear campaigns aren't intended to be resolved. The whole point of them is to throw out the allegations and never to investigate, never to get to the truth. And Virginians are way smarter than that.
So you say, obviously, Virginians are way smarter than that, but there's going to be a lot of Virginians, as is the case in politics generally. They will read the news now and again. They'll read the headlines now and again. Mm-hmm. The one thing they may have read was the allegations from earlier this year, and they may just remember the headlines. They may not remember everything thereafter. I mean, are you concerned that part of the campaign is going to be run on the defensive to a certain degree, having to explain what you just said to us to voters? And do you think they're going to buy it? Do you think they're going to say this is just too much? Like, we just want someone who doesn't have potentially these allegations against them?
Not at all. And in fact, again, what Virginians are doing is they're rejecting smear tactics. You know, we have someone in the White House at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue who lies to us every single day. And people say, well, you know, he's lying and we're overwhelmed and we just don't want to deal with it. No, people want people who are telling the truth. They want people who are engaging in politics that are uplifting politics, that are building people and communities up. They are really exhausted. And I'm telling you, I've traveled all around the state. They are exhausted of people in politics, especially politicians and people behind the scenes, orchestrating smear campaigns and doing hit pieces and not wanting to get to the truth. And, you know, they really are exhausted. And I'm telling you, people are going to be really surprised at the reaction that they're seeing. I mean, I have gone into so many different communities, but in particular, I've gone to, you know, different African-American mm-hmm. churches. You go to an African-American church in Virginia. And in particular, I was in Alfred Street Baptist Church recently, and there's so many other great churches, First Baptist Church of Vienna. You go there and you ask people what they think about these allegations. They think about the fact that they don't want to talk about them now, that the truth is out, that they think about that you would use, again, actually one of the historically most racist tropes in American history, to accuse an African-American man with zero evidence of a crime of this nature and then not want to talk about it. The backlash has been tremendous. And people, again, want to be uplifted. They want hope. And that's really what we represent.
When you first sued CBS in September, you were seeking $400 million. How did you come up with that dollar amount? And is that still the amount that you're seeking?
That is the amount. We also filed, Kojo, an amended complaint on October the 3rd. And as part of, you know, the litigation, we obviously have, you know, information and testimony and experts that testify to, you know, the damages that have been done. And again, this is, you know, there are so many things that go into that calculation, not to mention, you know, I'm an attorney. I was a partner at a law firm. I left my law firm this past summer.
Now, CBS is asking for the lawsuit to be dismissed. Exactly what's the status of the lawsuit now?
It is pending before a judge in the Eastern District of Virginia in federal district court, which is where we filed the claim. I used to be a federal prosecutor in that court and also was a law clerk out of law school. When I went to Columbia Law School, I clerked in that courthouse as well. And so we had the hearing a couple weeks ago, and then it's pending before the judge. But what's so fascinating is even as we stand now, even before that motion is decided, CBS no longer vouches for the truth of the story. Also, Meredith Watson, again, the accuser from Duke from 19 years ago, you know, her attorney, Nancy Erica Smith, also will not publicly vouch for the truth of the story. After 5 months of making these wild allegations, and when exculpatory information came out, they no longer want to vouch for the truth of the story.
Is there another side to this coin? In June, the Richmond Times-Dispatch reported that you said the scandal had raised your public profile for good. Do you think the media attention from these allegations could actually help you run for governor in 2021?
Well, Kojo, and we, you know, they conflated two different answers to two different questions. They asked me how I was being received around the Commonwealth, and I said that people, you know, are really supportive. I almost can't go anywhere in Virginia without people recognizing me and saying, hey, Lieutenant Governor, we support you. We're behind you. We know that this is all a smear campaign. We know that there are people behind this. It's incredibly obvious. You know, there's the mayor of Richmond, LeVar Stoney, and his former top aide, Thad Williamson, who just lost a race to Richmond City Council, and his wife, Adria Scharf, were texting with Dr. Tyson the weekend that Governor Northam got in trouble. And they one of the text messages says, you know, Governor Northam may be forced to resign tomorrow. We need to get your story out today. And they had another communication on Signal, an encrypted app, and it says Monday action. And of course, when I go back to Richmond on Monday after that weekend, I'm greeted by 100 reporters with this unfounded, uncorroborated allegation, again, which the Washington Post, by the way, had investigated for 3 months the prior year and did not print the story because it's uncorroborated. So, again, Virginians, everyday Virginians reject this kind of smear campaign. They really are tired.
I want to move on from this topic, but before we do, here's Iman in Chantilly, Virginia. Iman, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you for taking my call, Kojo. Justin, it's an honor to speak to you, sir.
It's an honor to speak to you.
Part of you. And you have two strikes against you. First of all, you are a wounded man, and they attack you, your dignity and your family and everybody. But my question is, how do you recover this problem? Because it seems to me that they requested that you should resign when things happen. And they treat you like you are a thug. There was a lot of name calling when things happened, and I'm so happy that you work out this thing and you fight back. My question is, how do you recover this issue? Since you wanna,
how do you move on from here?
Iman, thank you for the question. Let me just say something. God is good and the truth is on our side. And people have, again, you know, you get a lot of punditry, you get people in politics, a lot of insiders, you know, making different proclamations. But who they're not talking to is the people. And I talk to the people. I like to say 99% of Virginians are outsiders, and I'm one of them. I just happen to be elected to be lieutenant governor of Virginia. So I think what you're going to see and what we have seen over the past 10 months is this groundswell of support among people who say we reject this kind of politics. You know, people are calling for my resignation with zero evidence, zero due process, zero facts. They read two press releases. Governor Terry McAuliffe, within minutes of the second press release, calls for my immediate resignation. Well, if the lieutenant governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia, the second African-American ever elected in the history of Virginia, can't get any due process, if he would call for my resignation within minutes of seeing a press release, what does the average person on the street, what chance do they have? What chance does their son, their brother, their father have? And again, now that the last 10 months, we've seen the evidence come out and debunk these stories because they were false and fabricated.
But, so one just last quick question about this. I mean, obviously, in the national context, I mean, this came up in the debate over Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. I mean, his same defense was, listen, this is unproven. This didn't happen. She's lying, that sort of thing. And he had plenty of people on his side saying exactly that. And it really conflicted folks on the left that were saying, no, listen, we believe accusers. So you're a Democrat. You have to kind of appeal to those exact same voters in Virginia, those people who said, listen, we believe the people who are accusing Brett Kavanaugh of what he was accused of. So what's different about your case?
Well, Martin, a couple of things. First of all, we should believe facts and evidence. I think that regardless of your political party, that's what you should believe. Martin, let me ask you, do you believe the accuser in the UVA case, the Rolling Stone case? Do you believe the accuser in the Duke lacrosse case?
Right.
Do you believe the folks in the Exonerated Five? Do you believe the accuser in the Brian Banks case? When they've later admitted that they lied and fabricated the story.
Sure, but you could come up with just as many examples of cases where accusers said something, were told that's not true, and then ultimately the truth came out.
Mark, you know how you get to the truth? You get an investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And is it not striking to people that the only person who's called for an investigation over 10 months is the person being accused?
Right.
Is it not striking that the only person who's taken and shown lie detector tests, two of them, is the person being accused? Is it not striking that the only person who's filed a lawsuit to get to the truth is the person being accused? Again, smear campaigns are not intended to be resolved.
You mentioned former Governor Terry McAuliffe. He is likely to be one of your opponents if you run for governor, as possibly Attorney General Mark Herring, who has not indicated that he has changed his mind about running for governor. How do you think you'll beat those two opponents?
Well, as I tell you, Coach, I have never run against anyone in any election. I always run for something. Attorney General Herring and I were actually in a primary together in 2013. It was my first time ever running for office. I was 34 years old. We had the support of the people. By the way, we were counted out by, all the same voices that you're hearing today, all the insiders. And yet the people were on our side. We won over 48% of the statewide vote in that primary. We were also endorsed by the Washington Post. We lost by less than 2 votes per precinct statewide in my first ever run. And then we stayed involved and helped a lot of folks. And then, of course, when we ran in 2017 for lieutenant governor, we won a 3-way primary. Again, same voices, same naysayers. You're going to lose. We don't support you. We won almost 50% of the vote in a 3-way primary, which is virtually unheard of. And again, we're endorsed by the Washington Post in the general election. And then we beat a sitting incumbent state senator who had essentially, self-financing and money mm-hmm. pouring in. And yet we won that race and got nearly 53% of the
vote. Got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Virginia Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax. I'm Kojo Nand.
Hi, it's Diane. The next meeting of my book club is on Wednesday, May 31st at 1 p.m. Eastern. I'll host a discussion of Mad Honey by Jodi Picco and Jennifer Finney Boylan, followed by a conversation with the authors. Find out more and register at dianereem.org/bookclub.
Welcome back to the Politics Hour. Martin Ostermuhl is our guest analyst. He's a reporter for WAMU. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Will Smith, a member of the Maryland Senate. We're talking right now with Justin Fairfax, the Lieutenant Governor of Virginia, and taking your calls at 800-433-8850. Democrats flipped the General Assembly in November, and they're going to make gun legislation a top priority this January. A bill for universal background checks has already been filed. Where do you stand on different gun regulation like universal background checks, red flag laws, and the like? What do you want to see passed?
Yes. The two that you mentioned, I absolutely support them. These are bills that have broad support in the Commonwealth of Virginia. We've seen polls where upwards of 90% of Virginians support universal background checks and also with red flag laws. We see the importance of them also from some of the incidents that have happened recently. I was in Virginia Beach in the immediate aftermath of that horrific mass shooting. Virginia also, unfortunately, has dealt with these tragedies before in Virginia Tech in 2007, something we still remember, we'll never forget. But there's also gun violence that takes place on the streets every single day in both urban and rural areas. I've traveled around to places like Richmond and Danville and Norfolk and even in parts of Southside and Southwest Virginia. This is a constant issue. And so we have got to take common sense steps to address this. We all want to be safe. And we respect people's Second Amendment rights. I have people in my family who are avid hunters and very responsible gun owners, but they tell me all the time, I don't need an assault weapon to hunt deer. Those are meant for mass carnage. And so if we want to, again, be responsive to the community, to the voters, and also to keep our community safe, we have got to, take common sense steps to deal with these issues.
We got a tweet that says, as an attorney and lieutenant governor, can you tell us anything about what Virginia's response to so-called Second Amendment sanctuaries will be?
And just to add on to that, I just wanted to ask, do you think there's anything that the General Assembly could do that may be a step too far or a step too fast? Because again, Democratic majority won in November. It's coming in for the first time in a generation. I mean, there's a lot of excitement over what the General Assembly could do, especially when it comes to guns, which has been a big issue, like you said. But do you think that the General Assembly could make a mistake and push too far too fast with certain things and kind of upset voters, and then they get punished the next time elections come around? And this issue of Second Amendment sanctuary shows that there are people who passionately believe that something is going to happen, that their guns are going to be taken from them, that sort of thing.
Well, let me answer both questions. First, with regard to Second Amendment sanctuary, so-called sanctuary cities or jurisdictions, as has been made clear, that those have no legal force or effect. And I know that it's happening in various parts of the Commonwealth. And in fact, again, I was in Roanoke at a city council meeting, and there was some discussion about this at that mm-hmm. at that time. And so, again, I think what it is people are, sort of riling people up and ginning up this, stoking this fear that really is unfounded. Doing nothing is not an option. When we see the level of gun violence that we've seen, again, not just the mass shootings, but the carnage that builds up every single day. 33,000 Americans are killed every year by gun violence. And so it's a significant problem. As far as your question about going, sort of too far too fast, that's not something right now that I think is really on the table. Because, first of all, as you mentioned, Gojo, the voters spoke loudly and clearly. In November, they flipped both houses of the General Assembly. I preside over the Senate as Lieutenant Governor of Virginia, and I get to break ties when there are tie-breaking votes. We went from being 21 Republican, 19 Democrat to flipping that to now mm-hmm. 21 Democrat, 19 Republicans. In the House, we now have a solid majority of about 55 to 45. And so, again, the voters spoke clearly, and they want to see change. And common sense gun violence prevention was on the ballot. I mean, it's something that everybody ran on, just like, for instance, Medicaid expansion was on the ballot back in 2017. And as lieutenant governor, I broke the ties in the Senate to expand Medicaid to 400,000 Virginians, and already 320,000 have already signed up. And so we were hearing some of the same things. They had killed Medicaid expansion every year for about 4 or 5 years. And yet when we won, the voters spoke clearly that they wanted it. We passed it, again, on my tie-breaking vote in the Senate. And now 320,000 people have health insurance. I mean, there's that pent-up demand that the voters want us to be responsive to their needs.
Governor Ralph Northam released his two-year, roughly $135 billion budget this week. He's proposing increased taxes on gas and tobacco, but no increase to income tax. His priorities include cleaning up the Chesapeake, addressing the high mortality rate for mothers of color, and making community college tuition free for some Virginians. What stood out to you about this budget? Is there anything you would change?
It's a great budget proposal, and I was with Governor Northam earlier this week when we announced it to the money committees in Virginia, and this is the most progressive budget in Virginia history. And we are very excited about the investments that we're making, dealing with some of the critical issues in Virginia. Virginia is on a phenomenal trajectory. We are doing incredibly well as a Commonwealth. We have record low unemployment at 2.6%. Our AAA bond rating was reaffirmed. We're going to have our rainy day fund reach over 8% of our state's reserve for the first time in its history. I went from about $253 million in our rainy day fund when this administration came into office, and it'll get to about $1.9 billion. We're growing jobs. And let me just brag for a second. We've got Amazon HQ2. It's located in Virginia after a nationwide search. CNBC ranked us number one state in the country to do business. We are going to repair and fix the American Legion Bridge in an agreement that we have with Maryland. I'm mm-hmm. sure that will excite a lot of the listeners here who sit in traffic every day there.
Speaking of sitting in traffic, Jude tweets, with a new majority, are lawmakers in Virginia going to focus on expanding transit rather than Virginia's historical focus on widening highways?
Ah, it's a great question. And actually, you anticipated another thing I wanted to mention, which actually just today was announced, the administration, the governor, a $3.7 billion proposal to expand rail service on Amtrak and on VRE. So you have more routes going from Northern Virginia, Washington, D.C., Northern Virginia to Richmond, and also hopefully out to Hampton Roads and other parts of the Commonwealth. We have Amtrak service in Roanoke, Virginia. And we also got a dedicated source of revenue for Metro funding in the prior session, which, again, also very important in working with Maryland, D.C. Together and the federal government, having about $500 million annually put into the Metro system. And so, Virginia is doing tremendously well. And what I was always taught is, fix the roof while the sun is shining. So that's why we're making these great historic
investments. Marjorie in Alexandria, Virginia. Marjorie, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. Hi, Lieutenant Governor. How are you?
Hi, Marjorie. I'm doing well. Hope you're doing well.
I am. And I just wanted to ask you about your signature issue during the primary, which was breaking the pipeline from high school to jail. Could you talk to us about what's going on with that?
Yes, thank you. And for those listening, we absolutely highlighted what is known as the school to prison pipeline. Mm-hmm. And this is where young kids are being referred to the criminal justice system at an alarming rate. In fact, in Virginia, we were the number one state in the country for referring young people to the criminal justice system for in-school infractions. And that's really a travesty, and it must stop. We got some things done in the prior session around reducing out-of-school suspensions and also changing the way that young people are interacted with. And there's more to be done. I actually spent part of this holiday season, actually during the campaign as well, I go into juvenile detention centers and I meet with young people. I was just there maybe a couple weeks ago in Richmond. And, young people as young as 14, 15, 16, 17 years old. I said, there's no person that we're going to throw away in the Commonwealth of Virginia that we aspire to be. And I wanted these young people to know that they have a lieutenant governor who cares about them, who thinks about them. And despite what they may be experiencing in this moment, that there is hope and that we're going to invest hopefully in their futures as well as everyone else's.
Got an email from Susan, and I'm going to make this part of two questions because we're running out of time. I'm going to make two questions part of one. Susan emails, where do you stand on campaign finance reform, particularly as it relates to regulated monopolies contributing to candidates' campaigns? And where do you stand on creating a nonpartisan redistricting committee? Will the Democratic Party still push for this, even though they can now control the General Assembly?
Yeah, let me take both of those. I mean, I absolutely believe that we should have, some sort of campaign finance reform. Large amounts of money can often corrupt the system. We see at the federal level, obviously, they have, certain caps that were put in place. And I used to work on the Hill many years ago, and McCain-Feingold was sort of all the rage back in the early 2000s. And, we understand that large unlimited money has a huge impact. And as you know, in Virginia, there are no limits on the amount that an individual or a corporation can give. And so, we have some people in politics who go out and just get six-figure checks and, think that means support. While I wouldn't want people to not believe they can, sort of participate in the process, we need to have the voices of everyday citizens be heard.
Would you not take a six-figure check if offered to you?
Not under the current, I would under the current regime. In fact, we've been, in the last campaign, but we also had an opponent, whose father gave her six or seven figures. And as I tell people, I called my dad for $1 million check and he hung up the phone on me. And I love him dearly. But I would joke about that because that's sort of what you're facing in the current system. But I think the rules should be changed. You talk about regulated monopolies. I agree. I like the idea of not having contributions be made from regulated monopolies, not having that be allowed. And I, for instance, I've never taken a contribution from Dominion Energy, which, you have people in politics and the Democratic side. Many of them have taken large amounts of money from Dominion Energy. Some of them are now having a conversion and saying, I'm not doing it. But look at their record. If you go to vpap.org, you can see what money people have taken from whom. And so you have that as part of the issue. And then you had another question too, Kojo. There was a second part that was about redistricting.
Key issue.
Very big issue. We have to do something around redistricting. We already saw, frankly, in this election, the impact of having fairer districts. The courts had to step in to redraw some of the districts in Virginia that had been racially gerrymandered. And when those were redrawn, you had fairer races and you had different outcomes. And so I think we've got to really work on the mechanics of this. There's a lot of debate right now about what the right vehicle is. But I believe it is something that should be nonpartisan. I think it is something that should, be focused on, all of those elements that make these districts fair.
But with Democrats in charge, will Democrats finally do this? Because there's a lot of talk when a party
takes
over.
You're getting worse than Sherwood when it comes to time.
I love it. We need to do something. And I look forward to playing an active part in making our districts a lot fairer.
We left enough time for you if you want to make your official announcement here today. Your old friends in the District of Columbia would love it if you made the announcement where you were born in D.C.
I love the city. I was raised here. I was not born, but I was raised here. Actually went to high school in Maryland at DeBatha Catholic High School and give them a shout out. And now I live in Virginia. So I have the whole DMV covered in my background. But I will say this, Coach, I know we're going to go. I wish everybody a Merry Christmas, happy holiday season. We need to rise to the better angels of our nature. We need to stop the attack politics. People are done with it. They're exhausted of it, and we represent a new way forward. And I'm somebody, as you know, Kojo, who is the great-great-great-grandson of Simon Fairfax, who had been enslaved in Fairfax County, Virginia, freed in 1798 by Lord Fairfax. And now I'm serving as a second in command of the same state where he had been enslaved. So if that journey is possible through hope and opportunity and change, so much more is possible for the 8.5 million Virginians. And I look forward to fighting for everyone.
Justin Fairfax, he's the lieutenant governor of Virginia. He is a Democrat. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. God bless you both.
Going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Will Smith. He's a member of the Maryland Senate representing District 20. He's now the head of the Senate's Judicial Committee. I'm Kojo Nan. Welcome back. Our guest analyst is Martin Ostermuhl. He's a reporter for WAMU, and joining us in studio now is Will Smith. He's a member of the Maryland Senate representing District 20, which is Montgomery County. He is a Democrat. Senator Smith, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
Martin, before we get to Maryland specifically, the headline to your story in D.C. says D.C.'s plans to sell recreational weed are up in smokes thanks to a new spending bill. What happened?
So the big federal spending bill that passed Congress this year that's going to fund the federal government for the next year or so, it included, again, the prohibition against the district doing anything to legalize the sale of marijuana, which city officials have wanted to do for about 5 years. But in those 5 years, Congress has always said, no, you can't do that. Now, there was some hope this year that the prohibition would get lifted because Democrats took control of the House, and it was taken out of the House bill. But then it was included in the Senate bill, and then in the negotiations between the House and Senate, it wasn't taken out. So it's another year that the district essentially is being told there's nothing you can do about legalizing the sale of marijuana, regardless of whether you want to or not. It's just not something you're going to be discussing.
Until at least 2021, is that?
Yeah, September 2021 would be the earliest that that could change. But again, I don't know that there's a ton of hope that it's going to get lifted then either.
An all-too-familiar story. Senator Smith, Senator Bill Ferguson recently announced his picks for Senate committee leadership positions. You were chosen to head the Judicial Proceedings Committee. You won't have a lot to do there, according to the Montgomery County Sentinel article by Suzanne Pollock. The Judicial Committee is tasked with reviewing all legislation related to criminal and civil law, police reform, and gun control and other issues. It's also assigned legislation concerning constitutional amendments, corporations, family law, human relations, judicial administration, and court structure, as well as juvenile justice, the legal profession, public safety, landlord and tenant laws, and vehicle laws, including drunk driving. So like I said, you won't have a whole lot to do there.
A small docket ahead of us, yeah.
Do you think your appointment to this position should be seen as a kind of leftward shift? The position was left vacant by Baltimore County Senator Bobby Zirkin. Where do you fall ideologically compared to your colleagues in the Senate?
Well, first I'll say that there's no doubt that Senator Ferguson's ascension to the Senate presidency marks a generational and an ideological shift within the body. I'm personal friends with Senator Zirkin, but we just have some ideological differences. He's a little bit more conservative. I represent arguably the most progressive district in the state of Maryland, which is Silver Spring and Tacoma Park. So we'll definitely be bringing a set of background and values that are different to the assembly and to the committee this year than in years past.
So this is kind of getting in the weeds, but here we are. It's the politics hour. Let's get in the weeds. I've always been curious about this because you guys are, you have your annual legislative session, runs 90 days, part-time legislature. You guys are part-time legislators who have day jobs, who do other things, but ramping up to the legislative session, which starts in January, like, you know, Kojo just listed all the things that you're responsible for with that one committee. You know, how much prep work are you doing on a daily basis? How much is your staff getting ready for this? How much time is basically being consumed by what you're eventually going to do just for those 3 months?
As you said, we're a part-time legislature. Right. So you've got everyone that from people that have the bag groceries to a plastic surgeon and everything in between in terms of professions on the off season. But a considerable amount of time is spent prepping for the session with briefings during the interim, staff research, and it's just up to the individual senator or delegate to mm-hmm. engage. But especially for a session like this, when we have a huge transition, two new chairs in the Senate, a new Senate president for the first time in 32 years. Senator Miller was the only senator that was senator before he was Senate president. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge shift, and it's going to require a lot of study and attention, and it has for us. Obviously, for me, I didn't have as much time in the off season to catch up with the assembly because I was overseas, but it's a considerable amount of time, and it's not really a part-time legislature because you're always engaged.
You've been a guest on the show before, but not on the Politics House. So let's talk a little bit about your background. You gained some media attention at the end of the 2019 session when you deployed to Afghanistan with the Navy Reserve. Tell us about your work in the Navy, your recent deployment, and what it's like to serve constituents here while also serving your country abroad.
Sure. Again, we're a part-time legislature, so you have folks that have your foot in kind of both worlds. I practice law here in D.C. at the Solomon Law Firm in the interim, but I'm also in the reserves. So I was called up for essentially a 7-month deployment. I got to serve as branch chief in Kabul for governance and ANDSF, and it was an education, something that definitely broadened my worldview, but then also gave me a new perspective on the work that we do at the local level. And you know, a lot of amazing things happening. Obviously, the Afghan papers just came out. And that offers much needed light that needed to be shed on what's happening over there. But there are some really good things happening over there in Afghanistan. They just had their fourth democratic election on September 28th, although we don't have a result yet. Women make up a third of parliament in Afghanistan, and it's got a progressive constitution, more protective of religious and ethnic minorities than has ever been before. So there are some positive things that are happening there, but I'm really glad that the Afghan papers shed some much needed light on every aspect of what's happening there for the last 18 years.
Got an email from Scott who says, I'm trying to install a charger for an electric car in my condo, but my homeowners association won't let me. And there are hundreds like me. For several years, there's been a bill known as Right to Charge that would help, but it has died in the Judicial Proceedings Committee, which you now head. Can Senator Smith please seriously consider this bill when it comes through the committee? Can you go farther than considering it?
And probably worth noting, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's the country's only all-electric charging gas station is in Tacoma Park.
That's
is that
right.
Your district?
It opened up a couple months ago.
All right, there you go. So there's a right to charge at least there, but in someone's home, it's a little more complicated.
That's right. So I think bills like this, a lot of numerous transportation bills, we had an electrical tax credit for electrical vehicles that also languished in our committee last year. Things like this, small and large, we'll definitely take a solid look at, and something that I'm definitely in favor of personally, and we'll see if it's the will of the committee as well.
You plan on sponsoring the HOME Act this session, which addresses housing discrimination. Tell us about that bill.
Sure. It's a bill that prohibits source of income discrimination. And Montgomery County has had a law against this. Baltimore County just recently passed it. Anne Arundel County passed it, and Prince George's as well. So some of the largest jurisdictions in the state have passed laws preventing your source of income, to include alimony, benefits, checks, Section 8 vouchers. And the theory behind this, and which is actually borne out and been proven through all the counties, especially my county, Montgomery County, is that it gives access to folks in certain markets for housing that are closer to their workplace and more accessible for transportation. So it would allow for more folks access to quality housing. And that's something that's it's come up several years. It's languished in my committee in the Senate side. And so it's something that I'll make an aggressive push to get that over the finish line this year.
How confident are you that it'll pass?
I'm confident. We've done a lot of groundwork over the years. We've new momentum with Baltimore City, Baltimore County, Anne Arundel, Prince George's, Montgomery. I think that this is, between the progress that we've made around the state and individual jurisdictions and the shape of the body and the ideological slant of the body, I think I feel confident this year.
We're talking with Will Smith. He's a member of the Maryland Senate representing District 20, which is Montgomery County. He is a Democrat. We got a tweet from J.I., who says that now that Virginia has announced a deal with CSX to vastly expand and improve commuter and statewide rail service for one-third the cost of Larry Hogan's scheme to widen the beltway on I-270, when will Maryland put that kind of money into MARC and rail across the state?
Yeah, so it's funny. The lieutenant governor discussed that a little bit before, and I was talking to a colleague of mine across the street in the House of Delegates, Jared Solomon, who represents Montgomery County, and he said, why can't we do something like this? Why can't we redirect some of our resources to these types of transit solutions? And he's exactly right. Things like the Purple Line and the Red Line in Baltimore City that never came to fruition because the governor's priorities. I think those are the ways to right size and to ensure that we have environmentally sound, but also effective ways to move people to their job and to do their chores and to go about their daily lives. So, obviously, we've had a huge uproar and opposition to the governor's plan to widen 495. Earlier this week, Councilman Tom Hucker held a town hall. 300 people showed up to help to oppose the plan and to offer some different solutions. And our Prince George's and Montgomery County, the Parks and Planning, unanimously rejected the governor's plan to widen the Beltway. So I think we've had a very concerted and clear and concise argument against the plan, and I look forward to working with my colleagues in Montgomery County.
Would this be death by a thousand cuts for his plan, or can the governor just eventually decide if he gets the Board of Public Works to on board with him, can they just do this?
So it's exactly right. So the Board of Public Works has to approve this. It's a $9 billion public-private partnership. So I mean, this would be the largest project in the nation if it were to go through. Earlier this week, the governor announced the postponement of a meeting that
Board of Public Works.
Exactly right. So Comptroller Peter Franchot has said that he wants to reevaluate and understand fully what's going on. And that's certainly part of the governor's calculus as he was considered the swing vote on the three-member Board of Public Works. So I think we've made some tremendous progress from earlier in the summer, for sure.
Montgomery County Delegate Vaughn Stewart wants to introduce a bill that would ban privately run immigration detention facilities in the state. Montgomery County briefly became the center of the national discourse of immigration policy when it released an undocumented immigrant accused of rape on bond, which got attention from the White House. Where do you fall on cooperation with ICE? Would you support Delegate Stewart's bill if it gets to the Senate?
I do, because I think that creates a perverse incentive, a financial incentive for a jurisdiction to go ahead and enforce immigration law and round up folks that may not be here legally, despite the fact that they're creating no other criminal offense. And obviously being here illegally, being present is a civil crime, not a criminal offense. So I strongly support Vaughn Stewart's piece of legislation. Going further, though, I mean, we've argued over this before the last couple of sessions, and again, the bill has died in my Senate committee. Again, being present is not a criminal offense. I definitely support, if you have a criminal record and if you've committed a criminal offense, then fine. Law enforcement should use every tool at its disposal to get that person off the street, and yes, have that person deported. But the way that the 287G program is structured, and the way that programs like the one that you mentioned before are structured, is it gives incentives for federal money and for private money to go out and to get people that are otherwise creating no crimes, going to work every day, paying taxes in many instances. So, and ultimately making our communities less safe because people are less likely to cooperate with law enforcement.
Here's Darius in Somerset. Darius, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, how you doing, sir? Thank you, Kojo, for your show. If I may be brief, Senator, I live in a very, very poor county out here in Somerset, which is way on the eastern shore of Maryland. And I've currently come into a problem or issue myself, and I just wanted to go ahead and ask if there would be any type of reform on this. It's based on unemployment, and that issue is that I got back from Afghanistan after 2012. I got back. I lost my job. I was unemployed. The unemployment office has a requirement where you have to go and you look for work. I ended up doing that. I was approved for unemployment, at which point I got the job. But at the time I got the job, I lost my house. I lost my my car and position at the time.
Don't have a great deal of time left, Darius, but what is it that you would like the senator to do?
Senator, I have a case with the state of Maryland right now, and it is Darius Tillman versus Maryland CCU. If you could please look into this. I am, like I said, a veteran. I don't have many resources. I've been reaching out to my senators, and this issue of unemployment.
Is there a way, Senator Smith, that Darius can call your office?
Absolutely. Yeah. Darius, please get a hold of my office. Email me, call me. We'll work it out. The Secretary Owens, the Secretary of Veterans in Maryland, is tremendously responsive, and we have a great working relationship, and so I'd be happy to work with you on this.
Thank you very much for your call, Darius, and good luck to you. We got Luke from Tacoma Park who emails us. I volunteered on a few of the senator's campaigns. Can you ask him which bills he sees getting passed in his committee that were held up last year?
Ooh, that's a good question. So the Home Act is definitely one that I hope we'll get through. A number of the transportation bills that deal with local jurisdictions able to adjust their speed limits. That's something that's kind of antiquated, but something that we need our permission. So small things like that. You know, we're going to have some healthy debates on immigration, mm-hmm. and I think those bills will have a chance that they didn't have before. And there'll be some criminal justice things that, you know, that we obviously have to deal with. So, for instance, in Baltimore City, again, is experiencing a record high number of murders, 323, I think, to this point, which is the third straight year of over 300. We are going to have to find some ways to invest in community programs and some recidivism measures that maybe wouldn't have been entertained before. But we're also going to be faced with some options from the governor, that the governor is enhancing some penalties, has a couple bills that he wants enhanced mm-hmm. penalties.
So how about this one? In the 2019 legislative session, you sponsored a bill to legalize medically assisted suicide in Maryland, which is why you appeared on this broadcast. It ultimately didn't pass during a very dramatic vote in the Senate. You told the Baltimore Sun that you would sponsor the bill again, but likely not in the 2020 session. Why do you think you need to wait before introducing it again? Is that still the case, or do you plan on sponsoring it now?
Well, it all comes down to, it's a numbers game. So we got the bill out of the committee, though not in the shape that I would have liked it, but we got it out of committee, and it failed to prevail. By one vote, you know, you need 50 plus one, and it was tied, so it died on the floor in a dramatic vote. That vote is still not there, and we've got some vacancies in the Senate that have created opportunities for some folks to come over from the House potentially. One of those members from Baltimore County actually didn't vote for the measure in the House, and so then if you were to do the math, you'd be down two votes. So, like, instead of going through the same rigmarole in the committee and then on the floor again. If we don't have the votes, then we have to make sure that we make our political case. And if we can convince those two senators, then we can move forward.
Only got about a minute left.
All right, so I just want to get really local because all politics is local. Sure. One thing that's been roiling Montgomery County, also Howard County, is the issue of potentially redrawing school boundaries to address mm-hmm. racial inequities in systems that have otherwise been considered very high-performing and good for the counties. And this just came to a head this week or last week in Montgomery County, where there was a couple of public hearings that got very, very heated very, very quickly. You know, people left crying. There was yelling at mm-hmm. each other, that sort of stuff. Where do you fall on this issue? Do you think that school boundary redrawing should happen? Do you think there should be a discussion about it? Do you kind of, what's your feel?
Got about 40 seconds.
Sure. First I'll say we definitely have to address this. I'm from Silver Spring in East County. And so there's definitely kind of two parallels there with respect to our school system and something that we definitely have to address, not just within our magnet programs that mm-hmm. have folks come across jurisdiction. So definitely looking forward to that and definitely supportive of redrawing those boundaries.
Will Smith is a member of the Maryland Senate representing District 20, which is Montgomery County. He's a Democrat. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for it. It was a pleasure.
Today's show was produced by Sidney Grannon. Coming up Monday, remembering the famous and not so famous people we lost in 2019. And today, we say goodbye and give heartfelt thanks to our audio engineer, Josephine Neonai, who is taking her talents to NPR. Josephine is a gifted engineer and for more than a year has been an essential member of the Kojo team. She's cool and composed under the tightest of deadlines and the most unexpected of circumstances, and she still manages somehow to be one of the friendliest people here at WAMU. We will miss her at the Kojo show, but you'll still hear her work on NPR. It's the sound of when everything is going right. Josephine usually chooses the music you hear on the show today, but today I asked her to step away from the controls for a minute so that I could pick our closing song. Thank you, Josephine.
Hello, Josephine. How do you do? Do you remember me, baby? Like I remember you. At me and all the woo-woo-woo. I used to walk you home. I used to hold your hand. You used to use my umbrella every time it rained.
Nobody, but nobody does it better than Fats Domino. Thank you for everything, Josephine. Until Monday, have a great weekend. I'm Kojo Nahum.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Julie Deppenbrock, Sidney Grannon, Margaret Barthel, Lauren Marco, and Maura Curry. Our managing producer is Mana Kashvi. Our engineer is Josephine Neonai. Our intern is Laura Spitalniak. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kodjo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.